What's going on, everyone? This is the Post Booty Podcast for the weekend of December 12th, 2010. I'm here with my play cousins and vlog mates, Jamel.
Hello.
Nicole.
Hello.
Monica.
Hello.
And our long lost family, Joel, who just completed a long trip from Florida to Atlanta. What's up, man?
Yeah, hey, what's going on, y'all? I'm glad to be back. I'm sorry, I feel like I've been away for like a year.
No, it's cool.
We're glad you're sorry you're busy with real life. And
yeah, right. I have to apologize for like trying to earn a paycheck and things.
It's Thursday night here when we're recording, so a couple hours ago we just had Don't Ask, Don't Tell fall in the Senate. I'm going to talk about an article by the Charles Bentley, a former NFL player, on racism against white players in the NFL, and we're going to discuss Kanye West's new album. Or Jamel's going to bring us up to speed on what happened this afternoon.
So this afternoon, Don't Ask, Don't Tell came up for a vote in the Senate. When I say Don't Ask, Don't Tell, I mean the writer as part of the defense authorization bill. And there is some, so it's very odd what happened. Originally it wasn't supposed to come up today. Harry Reid was in negotiations along with Joe Lieberman with Susan Collins of Maine, who seemed to be open to some sort of deal, by which Republicans would get to vote on like a certain number of amendments. And Collins would vote for Don't Ask, Don't Tell, would vote for the defense authorization bill. And thus, Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal. For reasons I don't entirely understand, but I think are trickling out, Harry Reid brought the bill to the floor, sort of essentially challenging Collins not to vote against it. And it failed, as predicted, 57 votes to 40 votes, which because of at this point, automatic filibusters that happen for major legislation, the Democrats needed 60 votes to break this filibuster and get the bill to the floor. So that marks the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal by way of the defense authorization bill. As far as I understand, Lieberman and Collins intend to introduce a standalone bill to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I think, the commentary around it has been focused on the Senate as an institution. I think that's entirely right. More than two-thirds of the American public supports repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and more, 57 of the 100 senators in the United States Senate support repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That is a majority. And this is a failure of our system that something with such overwhelming support could fail, for reasons that have entirely to do with trying to maximize political advantage isn't a bad thing, but the, petty short-sightedness of this, I think, is striking.
We should also note that most of the military, the heads of the Joint Chiefs, are in favor of repealing it as well.
Right.
I think it's worth noting that there's essentially no empirical evidence remaining for not repealing it.
Well, like we've unearthed the fact that there never really was empirical evidence for keeping it. Like every last study that can be done.
Right, even though John McCain was one of the big opponents of moving ahead with the legislation, he kept asking for more time to deliberate and wait until the study came out, the study that the Pentagon was doing on, to see how it would affect troop morale and how it would affect...
But we should note that he switched, because he is now was very curious to know what the study was and wanted to hear more information about it, whereas before he was just like, we should repeal this. It's ridiculous.
Before he ran for president, yeah.
Right.
So now he's very much, he is very much kind of gumming up the works in a lot of ways. Not that, he is the only person who matters here, but he's been kind of the public face of a lot of the opposition.
It's interesting because I was watching CNN earlier tonight, God knows why, but, I heard Paul Begala say something about John McCain that, like, well, at least I can respect him, because he's, being upfront with his you know, opposition to Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but I'm like, actually, that's not right at all. Like, he's not. Like, it's the complete opposite.
No, you're right.
He's trying to couch his, like, I guess the best way to call it is bigotry. By, like, you know, let's go through all these hurdles and go through all these procedural, you know, obstacles to make this happen. But he's not just saying, I don't want this, which is not admirable at all. And I don't respect bigotry either. But I mean, it's not like he's being forward with, you know, what he really wants to happen here.
Right. Absolutely. He keeps moving the goalposts. He says, oh, well, once the study comes out and we see how the troops feel, then we should go from there. And then the study came back, you know, the reports came back and said that, you know, the troops really don't care. Most of them, you know, are in favor of repeal. And then he's like, oh, well, there's something wrong with the study. I mean, it's just, you know, it'll always be something else. It was interesting to see kind of how, not interesting, that's the wrong word, but everyone was kind of demoralized this afternoon. Just looking at my Twitter feed, it was just like this kind of massive outpouring of like sadness.
Well, because we have to say, like, the bill actually passed 57 to whatever it was, 43, maybe?
Right, 40. 40.
Like, it's ludicrous that a bill that has overwhelming support in the country and in the House can then fail in the Senate because of a weird procedural rule that the minority party has decided to invoke all the time when it used to be a rarity. Like, I really feel like more and more that Democrats should be like, fuck it, filibuster it, and let's wait till Christmas. Let's work through Christmas so that you can filibuster this stupid bill for no good reason.
The problem with that, though, is that for, like, what people call actual filibusters, the majority still has to be there. Like, the majority still has to maintain a quorum in the Senate. Like,
yeah, which they could do. I mean, this is something where it's like, I feel like 50 Democratic senators want to repeal some of these things enough because it's important to their base. Like, it's not just DADT. It's every other thing that happens. It's like paycheck fairness, all these things that are really critical to Democrats being elected. They need single women. They need gays. They need blacks and they need Latinos. They need those constituencies voting for them. And so, like, what Democrats should really do is just say, like, we're going to stay here until this stuff gets done. But they keep letting Republicans win the game, which I think is what's dispiriting.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even beyond the legislative quirks here, I think, you know, we were seeing in our timeline today, because, I mean, we follow all of us follow a lot of the same people. And I've said this before, it's like, I can't believe that we're actually like having this discussion in 2010, right? Like, it's like the sign of a really primitive, immature nation that like we can't get beyond this at this point, you know. And the thing is, the majority of the nation has. I mean, if you know, over and over again, people in polls say that DADT is something that they find objectionable. But even still, we cannot move forward on it. You know, like I said, beyond the legislative quirks, I think it's a disappointment that we're primitive in this regard, and also that like we can't see our government move forward, you know, on things mm-hmm. that there's a clear public will for.
Yeah, and we're not primitive in our thinking. This is not like an example of Americans being backwater conservatives who like don't understand diversity or whatever. This is like, it's a bit like the Dream Act, which also had a weird procedural hurdle today that like it sidestepped. But like,
you should explain what the Dream Act is.
So the Dream Act is a bill that would allow children who came here illegally when they were very young, and as long as they meet certain educational attainment, like if they go to college and have careers, after a really long time and after paying a lot of fees and taxes and being like essentially like a very stringent measure of what we would call a productive member of society, they get to earn citizenship. And so it's like, this is like a bill that's so like, it so puts the onus on the children of immigrants to perform, and it is so stringent and is so like the kids who would benefit from it are poster children for American dream success, that no one disagrees with it. Like, everyone agrees that like the straight A student whose parents brought them here when they were a baby and who makes it to Princeton and graduates and becomes like an engineer, like everyone agrees that we want that person to stay in this country. And so, and that's like basically what the Dream Act creates. creates is like this new generation of kids who stay here and become super hyper-performing Americans. Even that failed because of this stupid procedural rule in the Senate.
Well, so the question is, okay, so with the DREAM Act, it would be, I guess, what Republicans would be running from, or why Republicans would want to oppose it is because they don't want to be seen as soft on immigration. But what is the political upside for opposing Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal for them?
I mean, I think it's just a matter of unanimous or categorical opposition to everything the president does. I'm not sure this is actually a political upside. Like, I'm sure that some Tea Partiers are just like, ew, gays or icky.
But I was going to say, like, even in Arkansas, Arkansas doesn't support Don't Ask, Don't Tell by, like, 56%. There was an Arkansas poll right before the Senate election. And even Arkansans support repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell by 56 to something like 40. So, like, even a really regressive state like Arkansas, which makes
has
it illegal,
almost parity on did.
Yeah, well, has them a clear majority. And so, like, the political downside to Republicans is letting Obama succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the only thing we have going on here, is in a lame duck Congress. And also, like, Republicans only have one bargaining chip, which is the extension of the Bush tax cuts for those making more than $250,000. That's what they want. And so, like, until they get that, they really have no incentive to do anything.
Right.
And we talked about the upside, but, I mean, what's the downside to letting D8, you know, Don't Ask, Don't Tell fail? I mean, for Republicans and specifically Tea Partiers, I mean, there really is no – they won't get punished for that, at least in the immediate future,
no,
right?
No. There are no consequences for them.
Well, I mean, they lost the log cabin Republicans.
But
don't get them – like, eventually Republicans are going to do this. Eventually Republicans are going to vote to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But they don't want to do it while there's a Democratic-controlled House. They don't want it to be a Democratic victory. It's just partisan gamesmanship. And that's what's really depressing about it, I think.
I mean, and for my part, I don't see partisan gamesmanship as, like, particularly a bad thing. It's a bad thing when it interacts with, like, a legislative system that is – predicated on consensus and compromise. You know, like, if the Senate ran on, like, basically a majority rule, then I'd say, go ahead, Republican Party, oppose it all you want. But the fact that the Senate doesn't run that way, and that, you know, 57 votes isn't enough to pass a policy favored by the majority, makes this all very problematic and, like, you know, difficult.
How realistic is, like, filibuster reform, though?
I mean, I think there's momentum building for it. No one's proposing to abolish the filibuster. I don't think that's ever going to happen. It's unfortunate, and I think there is a brief window for it back in 2005 when then-Majority Leader Bill Frist threatened to end judicial filibusters. And if Democrats were smart, they would have, like, taken that as an opportunity to end the filibuster in general.
But at the time, they were, you know, the party out of power, so...
Right.
Well, also, let's be real too for a minute. Like, some of Bush's appointees were, I mean, this was like Bush and conservative presidents of the past few years have, past few decades have valued stacking the court on the conservative side much more than Obama currently values stacking it on the liberal side. So some of the appointees were just, like, ridiculous. What is different though is that the Democrats didn't use the filibuster this much.
Are these even technically filibusters? Just like a threat of filibuster?
It's just a threat of filibuster, right. Yeah. It's just, I mean, no, technically a filibuster would be the cloture vote would fail and...
And then everyone would.
And then Democrats would force the everyone to stay on the floor to maintain quorum. And Republicans would have to stymie debate by... Like, you have to... Which is like old, like, Mr. Smith goes to Washington kind
of thing. But I mean, like, those filibusters haven't happened for decades.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just that, like, it makes – but it's so onerous for the majority to maintain that it's easier to just sort of, like, if someone initiates a filibuster, then you just, like, set that aside, let that process go through and move to some other business. Like, I mean, one of the interesting things about all the filibuster reform proposals is that they're essentially predicated on making the filibuster more onerous for minorities. Because right now, it's like a low-cost, high-reward thing. Like,
yeah.
For the minority, initiating a filibuster costs almost nothing. And even if it's bound to fail, the whole process of it failing takes about a week. And so it wastes the majority's time with little impact on the minority. I forget who has submitted a proposal, but the proposals to reform it essentially reverse the calculation and make maintaining a filibuster very difficult for the minority.
Yeah, that's what it used to be. Like in the days when you had to keep speaking on the Senate floor, you also had a bigger majority required to break it. So this is the result of kind of a gentleman's agreement that made it like easier to have a filibuster, but also easier to break it. But what's happened now is what you have actually is the bare majority holding up all of Senate business. Like, it's not just that they're holding up one bill. They want to hold up everything until what they want is dealt with.
Not necessarily. I mean, that's how it used to be, is that a filibuster shut down Senate business entirely. Nothing could happen until it was dealt with. In the 70s, things were altered a little bit so that if a filibuster were initiated on something, it would go on the second track, and it would be sort of, you could do two things at the same time, essentially.
Yeah, but what I'm saying now is effectively Republicans are holding up all Senate business until the tax bills vote
right,
on.
Right.
Because you had a bunch of Republicans today theoretically saying that they would support repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but they wanted to deal with tax cuts first. So right. You have like the majority able to hold the Senate hostage.
But I guess what I'm saying is that, like, to be precise, right, that it's like, it's not that this single filibuster is holding the entire Senate hostage. It's that if X thing doesn't happen, the Republican Party is going to call filibusters and hold on every individual thing that needs to happen.
Which to me is worse because it's just the threat of it. You don't actually make them have to go through any sort of action or be responsible for any of the repercussions for doing so.
Switching gears back to the White House, though, I mean, Obama has been saying for months, you know, every time DADT came up from challenges in the court, the White House and DOJ kept saying that they wanted to they didn't want to deal with it in the courts. So they wanted to go the legislative route and DADT repeal. And so now, you know, I guess we're kind of left to the Lieberman-Collins bill, which may be forthcoming. But what does the White House do going forward?
I'm not sure.
You know, I mean, they're in the weird position of defending Don't Ask, Don't Tell, even though they say they want to repeal it. But, like, they can't pretend as though this is something Congress is going to deal with reasonably anymore, because it's only going to get worse, probably. And so, like, yeah, they have to do something about it, and I don't know if they're going to, but, like...
What could they do? I mean, what are their options?
Well, Obama could very easily stop enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Right, by executive order, right?
Yeah.
Okay. But do you think he does that now? I mean, isn't that less likely to happen now?
Well, I don't know if it's less likely to happen now, but it shouldn't be, because he gave Congress its chance. But, like, actually, like, they had the perfectly good excuse in letting the courts overrule DADT, and then they decided to defend it. So, by appealing the stay, like, basically the court was like, until this issue is hashed out, you can't keep discriminating against people. And the administration was like, well, yes, we can, and here's why. And they argued for...
yes, we can.
Like, exactly. Like, you know, it puts him on the weird position of being, like, against a really important constituency for him and for the Democratic Party.
Like, now for, like, a quick defense of the legislative strategy, I just think, I mean, Obama could have repealed it via executive order, but it would have become a political football that every, you know, the next Republican president would reinstate it, so on and so forth.
But do you think, like, that's true? I mean, it's one of those things that is so unpopular that wouldn't it just kind of fall victim to inertia and, like, the status quo? I mean, why would there be any compelling reason to reinstate it in, let's say, Obama doesn't get reelected in 2012 and a Republican takes over? Like, why? Why would a Republican president, like, reinstate this policy that doesn't have any broad support, right?
So what I think would happen, I mean, this is... So the benefit of the legislative approach, sort of the slow burn approach, that you build so much consensus among everyone in the political system that, you know, the momentum is there for repeal. The problem with an executive order is that it becomes a strictly partisan thing. Democrat president repeals Democrat, you know, like, does Democrat priority. And the fear, I think, and I think it's totally understandable and probably right, is that it wouldn't matter if the public at large thought it was shitty to reinstate Donuts and Tell. If base Republicans thought, you know, we have to roll back everything the Democrats did, including this executive order, then, you know, regardless of the merits of repealing Donuts and Tell, it just becomes this partisan football by default, that Republicans want to see it reinstated because a Democrat did it.
Well, I would say that that's true in most cases, but I don't think it's true in this case because support for it is so shallow. There's very little support for keeping it. So it's like another option that Obama had was to like, I can see why the administration wanted to appeal the decision by the district court just because it's in the habit of defending federal law. But like, it could have not appealed the decision to stay enforcement. This is a decision where with this law in particular, I think if Obama decided to undo it by executive order, should he be in office for another 4 years after these, there's not going to ever be a Republican elected who's going to reinstate it. Even if it's important for the Republican base, the minute that a Republican Party does that, whoever is in Congress is going to then take action against it. It's just not the kind of popular thing that is going to, once repealed, once you give rights to a group, it's really hard to take those away.
That'd again. Be really hard to explain. I mean, yeah, that would be really hard to rationalize, you know, publicly, you know, why you would do that. But I think my thing is, whoever thought that Joe Lieberman would be on the right side of history?
No, right. He's been persona non grata for the last, and rightly so. I mean, you know, the antipathy thrown his way has been completely probably justified. I mean, he's just so slimy, you know what I mean? So mendacious all the time. But no, I mean, you're right. It's also a relatively safe issue, and it plays a Joe Lieberman's kind of you know, his penchant for grandstanding, you know what I mean? Like, he gets to be self-righteous and you know,
whatever. Joe Lieberman's trying not to get fired in 20...
So, moving from one basket of discrimination to another one, in the sports world, Joel shared an article in our weekly roundup by Charles Bentley, a former NFL player, who insinuated, I guess, that white athletes get a raw deal in the NFL. Joel, you want to explain what the article is about?
Yeah, well, it was sort of interesting. It's something that we heard in the last few months, but there's an NFL running back right now, plays for the Cleveland Browns. His name is Peyton Hillis, and he's had what has been a pretty surprising season. I mean, he may even be, you know, voted to the Pro Bowl. And what makes his story unique is that he's white. And if you know, this being 2010, I mean, it's been a long time since there have been like really productive white NFL running backs, or, you know, or not, maybe productive is the wrong word, but star NFL running backs that were white.
Like, and John Riggins,
Larry Zonka, yeah. You know, but they're all sort of in the same mold. And so is Peyton Hillis. He's sort of a big, burly, fullback sort of built guy. And so, you know, Charles Bentley sort of, you know, traces what happened in his career. When Peyton Hillis was in college at the University of Arkansas, he played. Yeah, right. Yeah, right. He played.
Pig Suey.
Yeah. No, oh, my gosh. I hated that as a kid. He played with two other running backs who were both first round draft picks, and they're good running backs in their own right. But to this point, neither of them have had the sort of star turn that Peyton Hillis has had. And Peyton Hillis, he toiled on the Denver Broncos roster last year until he got traded to the Cleveland Browns, and now he sort of flourished. And so what Charles Bentley was sort of saying is that, and I'll quote him here. The coaches and executives who were the gatekeepers of antiquated ideologies on who was physically and mentally equipped for particular jobs. As the black players settled into and accepted their roles, the white players did the exact same because players understood the only thing they could control was their performance. Coaches and executives understood they could control everything. And so sort of what I think LaCharles Bentley is getting at is that the part of racism that's really insidious, I mean, there's a lot of things that are insidious about racism, is that it sort of leads to a failure of imagination and groupthink. And so somebody looked at a guy like Peyton Hillis, this white guy, big guy, you know, there's probably all sorts of ways that people would describe him, gritty, tough, you know, anything but athletic.
Right, absolutely.
Right. And it sort of serves as a discrimination against him because he had to wait until well into his NFL career to get this sort of opportunity. He didn't even get this sort of opportunity to excel at the position of a lead ball carrier in college. And it's sort of interesting. And I think, you know, it's interesting in another way because a lot of people think that sports is like, that there's not racism in sports, that like, you know, that there's performance and that, you know,
right, sports is a perfect meritocracy, that everyone who works hard, you know, and has the ability is rewarded, you know, accordingly or whatever.
Yeah, I'd like to take this opportunity to point out that the reason why most running backs are black is because black people are actually better equipped to be running backs, evolutionary speaking.
Whoa, wow. It's like Jimmy the Greek right now.
Yeah, I know, right. our big thighs and
what is it? No, I don't know about that at all. I mean,
our big thighs and our mechanical enhancements. What? What's so funny?
Do you really believe that, Nicole?
No.
Oh. You said it so straight. I was like,
wait a second.
Oh, my God.
There's no reason for me to think you were being sarcastic. I'm not. Yeah, I was like, what?
Right.
But you were saying, Joel, sorry.
Yeah, but no, what's sort of interesting is we saw this also last year when the runner-up for the Heisman Trophy was a white running back from Stanford, Toby Gerhart, and a lot of people, he didn't get drafted nearly as high as somebody with his resume would have been drafted. I mean, he ran for a lot of yards, a lot of touchdowns, he carried his team, he's a big guy, he was a star on the baseball team, so obviously he had some athleticism, but they kept trying to fit him into this mold of, you know, the grinded out fullback guy, instead of looking at him and saying, this is what his performance and his production merits. Like, maybe he deserves a chance to play running back.
Right.
And so, you know, you kind of see that play out all over again, but I don't know. You know, the other part of that is that it leads to racism on the other side, to me, in my opinion, because with black athletes, you hear a lot about us being athletic and being natural, as if, like, you know, effort in work and work ethic don't play a role in this, you know, people excelling at that level.
Right. No, I've read it, and it was interesting. LaCharles Bentley was saying that, I guess, on a free agent trip, one of the teams was trying to court him, and he was just, they sat him down and showed him some game film, and he felt as if they were condescending to him, like, we just want to make sure you understand the concepts. And he felt that, you know, if he were a white athlete, that would have never happened, he actually wasn't sure if it would have happened, if they would have assumed that because he was a center, he played center on the offensive line, which is one of the positions that's considered like a position for cerebral, smart guys, that question would have never come up in his like kind of free agent recruitment, like if he could handle the intellectual rigors of, you know, reading the defense, like, or the defensive line or whatever. And so, it is very interesting to watch, the way race plays out in the NFL, because, you know, for a long time, you know, there was this like kind of, there's this kind of prohibition on black quarterbacks. And every time there was a black quarterback, right, there was all this, I mean, like you said, there's all this like coded language about race. Like, you never hear white athletes in football or otherwise ever referred to as athletic, even when, you know, I mean, you know, someone like, you know, Joe Jourovicius or Wes Welker is always just like a tough, he puts a lot of effort into it. It's like,
he's a smart player.
He's scrappy, right. It's just, and it's so strange. It's like, no one who is a premier receiver in the NFL is not like in the upper 1% of, like, you know, like physical, like, I mean, just in terms of physical ability in the world. I mean, it's like, I mean, I can't think of any white guys who have been running backs in my lifetime, though. That's the crazy part. It's like, Mike Alstott is the only one who's, I think, but he wasn't even a feature back. He was a fullback.
He shared carries with
Work Done. Right. And so, but even like white wide receivers is always, like, you always hear them compared to each other. It's like Joe Jourovicius and Ed McCafferty and all these guys. Like, there's not even an ability to scout to talk about talent. Like, you can't say this 6'3" white guy with really long arms has a game or is very similar to, you know, I don't know, Amani Toomer. They would always say, they would always point to the last white guy who was good at the position. It's like, it's so weird because, like, their games might not be at all similar, you know?
Right. Yeah, every white guy is Steve Largent. Every white receiver in the NFL is Steve Largent, you know? They're all possession receivers. They all, you know, succeed on their guile and, you know, their wits, you know, not athleticism. And it's sort of like, you know, that's the problem you have in retrospect with a movie like White Men Can't Jump. Is that, like, it sort of, like, reinforces these, like, really rigid racial stereotypes that, like, white athletes do this and black athletes
do that. Yeah, absolutely.
And you'd think that people at that level of sport would be beyond that. That, like, you think that, oh, these are really smart people, that they, like, you know, that they examine and they have all this analysis and they have all this data now that allows them to overcome their racism. But that's the thing about racism that's so weird, is it's so insidious and it pops up in places that you wouldn't even think, and in this case, it's limiting the white athletes. You know?
Right. Even when you have an overwhelming amount of evidence that suggests that someone might be good at something. I mean, like, black athletes are always, there are all these guys who were college quarterbacks who get turned into like wide receivers in the NFL or defensive backs or whatever. Like, athletes, positions that are, like, you know, relegated to athletes. I mean, it's kind of amazing that. Once there was an influx of black quarterbacks, it happened really quickly. I mean, it was all, like, in the, you know, I mean, it was, there was one point it felt like every other team had a black quarterback, which felt like,
yeah, right.
I mean,
right.
You know, but for the entire history of the NFL, that was never true. I mean, it was just like, if you were athletic and black and you played quarterback in college, that's great, but we want you to try to be, you know, our slot receiver in the NFL or whatever.
As I said, there's two things that I want to mention about this. First of all, I don't necessarily disagree with what the article says, but what worries me a little bit, and this goes back to what you guys were saying earlier, is that Peyton Hillis is pretty much our only test case right now, so that makes me a little leery of, like, declaring this as a trend. Like, I think he could very well be right, but just when you only have one person, like, people can look at it and be like, oh, well, he never made it because, you know, he's playing for the Broncos, or, you know, and then he got traded. Like, you could make excuses, or there could be mitigating circumstances or something like that. So I personally think that he's probably right, but I think that we should be careful because, I mean, what else do we have to compare it to right now?
I think that's part of the, I think that kind of underscores the point, though, right? I mean, if there aren't any white running backs, it's not as if black people and white people live together, you know, and, like, elsewhere in the United States. I mean, there are plenty of kids growing up who are white kids who grew up, you know, in all-white neighborhoods or all-white communities who, and their football teams have white running backs, right? So, like, what happens to all those white running backs? What happens to all those black quarterbacks on the way up, you know, the ladder of competition, you know, as they get older and older? Like, the fact that there aren't any white running backs in the NFL, it speaks, I think, volumes about, like, the kind of, like, entrenchment of, like, certain ideas. And I mean, even if he's the fact that he is the only one is, I think, a pretty,
I'm really tempted to make another joke about natural abilities, but I'm a little afraid that you might actually think
of right, well, the further...
touch on what Joel said about work ethic, and just about how... I could be wrong about this, but it seems like, for example, and what I'm thinking about right now is Vince Young, is that whenever something goes downhill with the black quarterback, you tend to hear about work ethic more. It's like, oh, well, he just, you know, he's not putting enough into it. He doesn't have the right work ethic. And almost, it seems to me at least, like there's an undercurrent of, well, he was never really smart enough to get this.
Right,
anyway.
Absolutely, right. I mean, right. We always hear this nonsense about Wunderlich scores. Wunderlich scores are the NFL institutes a kind of assessment, an aptitude test that they give to prospective draftees. And, you know, the Wunderlich scores of black quarterbacks come out all the time. I mean, like, they always become these big deals. Like, this, like, you know, and this is true of all aptitude tests, but we find out that, like, Wunderlich scores have, like, no correlation to how good somebody does in the NFL as a quarterback or whatever. But every time a black quarterback...
Dan Marino scored relatively poorly on the Wunderlich.
Right,
know?
And he was, he had, like, all the NFL passing records, right? And so, like, this is what happens is, like, whenever black quarterbacks get, or, you know, whenever it's draft time, it's always like, oh, this person did really poorly on this aptitude test. And it kind of reinforces this idea that black people or black athletes are just like not mentally not up to the intellectual the mental rigors of, you know, the quarterbacking position. But and it's weird because I feel like this story kind of takes this issue, like the way race plays out in the regular, like in the regular world, in the rest of the world, and makes it like, oh, this poor white guy got screwed. This is one of those things that I imagine gets vigorous cosigns from people who wouldn't otherwise look at the way race plays out in the NFL and all kinds of other ways, you know?
Yeah, well, we talk about that now, and it's interesting you brought that up, because nobody, I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of people that say LaCharles Bentley's piece here, oh, that's really interesting. But if we look at the flip side of it, and we talk about what happened with Donovan McNabb earlier this year, when his coach, Mike Shanahan, subbed him out for Rex Grossman during a two-minute warning, a guy, I mean, if anybody who ever, people who have not watched football could look at Rex Grossman play quarterback and watch Donovan McNabb play quarterback for, like, you know, a couple snaps and, like, well, one of these guys is much better than the other, and it's not.
He's not Rex Grossman. Right.
It's not Rex Grossman. But, right, but Mike Shanahan said, you know, this really coded language, once again, that, well, you know, that he wasn't in great shape, and that we thought that, you know, Rex was more familiar with the offense, and that he could do some things that Donovan McNabb couldn't, and it's still kind of taking shots at, you know, his intelligence and his work ethic all in one.
Right, absolutely.
And I've never heard anybody ever say that about a quarterback of that stature in NFL history. I mean, I followed football since I was six, and I've never heard anybody, a coach, say that about their franchise quarterback like that publicly.
I got to say I was okay with that because I hate the Redskins, so...
Yeah. I mean, I'm a Phillies, an Eagles fan, so, you know, I feel some type of way about that whole McNabb situation in the first place. You're right. I mean, it's there's not a quarterback. I mean, Brett Favre makes the kind of, even now, I mean, well, he's kind of a shell of his former self at this point, but, like, even now, he makes really, really horrible decisions with the ball, and he always has. I mean, he was always fun to watch because he could do really, you know, incredible things, you know, just improvising. But he would do a lot of boneheaded things, and it was never seen as, like, evidence of, you know, the lack of mental acuity of white quarterbacks. You know what I mean? It was like, as done for
the time. Probably that Brett Favre had the luxury of being able to basically sort of dumb himself down and pretend like he wasn't a very smart person, and it was fine. Like, nobody thought anything of it. It was sort of like, oh, well, you know, he's a regular guy or whatever.
He just wings it. He wings it out there, you know. He plays with passion. You know,
he's just out there having fun.
Yeah, right. Instead of, like, you know, but he has that luxury. And, you know, what's sort of interesting, you know, bringing it back to Vince Young, is that, like, I think about a guy, you know, this piece, like, all of a sudden, like, people say, oh, wow, you know, there might be racism in sports. And I remember when Sean Hannity, you know, took up the case of that, the guy I mentioned earlier, Toby Gerhart, and he's like, well, there's reverse racism in sports, you know, right? But then you think about Vince Young's coach, who I'm just going to beat the drum on now because is a Houston Oilers fan. Jeff Fisher was the coach out there. And Vince Young is near and dear to my heart. I'm from the south side of Houston. So is Vince Young. And so Jeff Fisher has kind of gone out on this campaign to embarrass Vince Young. But you look at it, and I think you talk about racism, but I think about a guy like Jeff Fisher who's been to the playoffs six times in 17 years, not won many playoff games, been to one Super Bowl and lost.
That's an abysmal record.
How has he been able to last this long? And then I think about a guy like Dennis Green.
Right.
Who... had, you know, roughly the same success, but he's out of the league now. And
absolutely.
So, yeah, all of a sudden people are saying, well, that's racism. But, I mean, think about also, you're kind of, you know, bringing this around, even talking about, you know, again, talking about racism in sports and opportunity. I mean, this is what this is about, how racism diminishes opportunity, right?
Absolutely.
Well, and we're going to, you know, I know only so many people are interested in it to this point, but there's a coaching job came open in college football this week, the University of Florida, one of the best coaching jobs in the country. Right, yeah, Urban Meyer, their coach for the past few years, stepped down. It's one of the best jobs in the country for obvious reasons. It's in Florida, which, so you have proximity to a lot of great athletes. They have a lot of money. There's a lot of support. They have a recent history of success. There's everything you want there. And they're naming the candidates for the job, and not one of them is black. And the thing is, I'm thinking back, there's never been a black coach in college football who's ever got an opportunity at a job like that.
Well, there was, I wonder why. There was Ty Willingham at Notre Dame, but he was pilloried. Yeah. I mean, he...
It was hard. Right. And he didn't do well, but the guy that followed him didn't do well either. And
right.
You can say Notre Dame hasn't really been a national power since I was in elementary school. Well, at middle school, right? They're a prominent program, but they're not a powerhouse. And you know, the problems that have been endemic in that program have been there. It wasn't just Tyrone Willingham, you know? So I just wonder, you know, I think maybe that's what Charles Bentley was getting at, is that racism can lead to the limiting of opportunities. There is only one, you know, there's only one prominent running back in the NFL right now, right? And it's this Peyton Hillis guy. But how many others are not getting this opportunity? And on the flip side, how many black coaches are not getting the opportunity to be head coaches of things? I think that's the important thing that I take from here. It's not the trend. The trend is the racism, not white running backs. The trend is the racism that is endemic in the sport, and we don't talk about it a lot. And it's interesting that it took a white guy, you know, racism against a white guy, and diminishing the white guys are talking.
Right.
But, I mean, that's how it is.
Because I'm taking from Monica and Jamel's, like, stunning silence that we should probably move on.
Right. We did bring up Arkansas.
Yeah, that was the last time I said anything. Y'all didn't notice. I totally, like, went and got a drink of water.
So switching gears, we're going to kind of stay in the realm of pop culture a little bit. Kanye West has been kind of ubiquitous over the last, it seems like for the last 2 years, but especially over the last couple of months, as he's been, gearing up to put out his album, My Beautiful Dark Twisted Fantasy, which has been everywhere, and he's been everywhere, and everyone's been calling it a masterpiece. And, I'm kind of, I remain kind of a Kanye agnostic. Like, some days I, like, hate his guts, and other days I'm indifferent, but, I find the zeal for this album kind of baffling. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, because you've all heard it, but, It's not a bad album, but I feel like some of the praise is so hyperbolic. Like, this is the best pop album since Thriller, and he's just, and I'm like, what are we doing right now? Like, I mean, part of it
is like Beach Boys combined with Michael Jackson combined with George
Michael. I'm curious as to what you guys think of the album specifically, but all the other stuff around Kanye, like the kind of his kind of coronation as like this very smart pop star with like really interesting and important things to say about the world we live in.
Okay, yeah. I mean, I got the album the first day it came out. I really, you know, was excited to hear it. And I mean, it is a very good album. I mean, it's probably, you know, the best album I've heard this year. Which isn't saying anything. I'm 32 and married. Like, I mean, you know, I didn't know what test it was until like, you know, like 3 weeks. Right, and how to pronounce that right?
I saw you bringing up that Michael McDonald.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? So like, I'm willing to, you know, drift off into middle age here, but I agree. Like, I just don't see this. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's that much better an album than College Dropout, you know, or Late Registration. No, actually, I love Late Registration is probably my favorite of his albums. Right, but. Like, I mean, this album is good, but first of all, there's a couple of things missing, like fun. Like,
yes.
It's a really dark, sad album for, like, hedonists.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. Man?
You know, it's just, I mean, and I don't want to be one of those, because, like, every hip-hop writer, like, pretty much gets off on the, well, you know, unlike all those other rappers who are into jewels and women and, you know, crack, you know? Yeah, I'm not saying that, but, I mean, that's kind of what this album is, and it's sort of, but there's nothing on this album that I can grab onto and say, well, like, there's some sort of, you know, deep, meaningful message here.
You're right. This is a really kind of joyless album. A friend of mine was, like, saying, and she thought that All of the Lights was this, like, really triumphant song that makes you feel really good when you walk down the street. I was like, nah, it's about a dude who beats his girlfriend and gets sent to jail. You know what I mean? This is...
I don't know, like, I really enjoyed the album. I really liked the production on it. I would agree that the album isn't exactly, you know, fun,
per se. It's like 808. 808 and Heartbreaks in that sense. It's not purely a fun album, but some of the songs I do think are enjoyable. I don't know. My problem with Kanye West is just sort of like, he's so damn pretentious, and it annoys me. When it comes down to it, Kanye West is a rapper. He's not that important.
I was listening to the Slate Culture Gabfest yesterday, and Jody Rosen, he's their culture, their music critic. I think he was saying that he felt that this album was kind of Kanye's, like, Kanye was kind of positioning hip-hop as, like, a political act, this is a way in which, this isn't new, obviously, but Jody Rosen saying this is, like, Kanye's first kind of real, the first time that Kanye's really going to, down this route where, he's making music that is, like, kind of angry and political. I don't know that I buy that, necessarily.
Well, what's political about it? What would be political in the music? I just need to explain that to me.
I mean, I feel
if he means political in that it's offensive, then his video certainly qualifies. The preview for the video for Monster came out yesterday, I think, and it's designed to make people hate him. I think it's basically like Kanye kissing on emaciated models in various stages of death. It's just no good.
Since you brought up Monster, though, I was wondering what you guys, because you've heard the album, what you thought of it. Because I think that song is interesting on a couple of levels. One, because Nicki Minaj, who I previously, me and Joel had this running, you know, giggling at her kind of ineptitude, she kind of owned that song. Like, she, like, just ran roughshod over everybody on that song. Which is a song, I think... It kind of represents, like, a lot of reasons I don't like the album. Like, there's all this extra shit happening in that song. It's kind of unnecessary. Like, why is Bon Iver on it, really? Like, why does he need to be there? Rick Ross is on there for two lines. You know what I mean? It's just a really busy song in which a lot of stuff is happening, but none of it is, like, really useful. Like, why couldn't... He's at this point where he can just do everything big because, like, oh, I'm going to have Aretha Franklin playing the spoons in the background. I'm like, Kanye is a genius. He's only Kanye could get this shit to happen. Like, you know what I mean? This is, like, what keeps happening.
Not Michael Jackson isn't the right word, but, like, indeed, he can work with whoever he wants. Like, if he says, you know what, I want this... And it's a way of, like... It's sort of like an ego play. Like, well, you know what? I can get Jay-Z to be on my album, like, three times. You know what I'm saying?
If Kanye were really ambitious, though, he'd, like, think bigger. He'd be like, y'all want to get Jacques Chirac to play the flute? Because Jacques Chirac can play the flute. I don't care.
You know what? He tried to break violin into hip hop. You know what I'm saying? Like, I was actually thinking about what happened to what's the young lady's name? Mary
Ben-Ari, I want to say, but that's I feel like that's going to be kind of wrong.
Yeah, right. It's close. But you know, he's trying all this. But I mean, you know, I think even beyond music, I think like, and I maybe this is what gets at you, G, is that you know. This album is sort of vapid and empty, and, like, I kind of feel like it's sort of like Kanye, like, now. Like, it's sort of him, right? So we have to get past this idea that people can be geniuses in more than one field, right? Like, some people are really good at a lot of things. Some people are good at music and, you know, writing and, like, you know, playing the tambourine, okay? But, like, you know, to look to him to say anything else outside of his lane or, like, comment on politics or, like, you know, things like that, like, maybe the expectations people have on him are, like, this, you know, the talents they've conferred on him outside of music is sort of annoying, but, like, you know, he's worth listening to outside of music. And if he, I'm not saying that it's not possible for somebody to be good at music and good at other things, but, like, or that they don't have anything valuable to say, but like with Kanye, I've kind of like gotten to the point where like if he's not talking about music, I don't really give a shit about what he's talking about. You know?
Right.
See, but I don't expect him to be like wise and you know, learned. I just like expect him not to cry during a Jay Leno interview and like not to. No, I mean, it's a little bit like what I expected with Britney, like when she was going through the bad time and she showed up.
Oh, the bad times are over.
I mean, when she first started going through the bad times.
Oh, okay.
And she showed up on whatever show she was on or whatever with, like, her nails, like, the polish chipped off and, like, sobbing and, like, barefoot, basically. Like, I just expect you not to go through a certain level of that. Like, you never know what he's going to do. He's, like, completely unpredictable.
I think that's, like why people love him, which is,
right.
I find fascinating because, I mean, it's not that I want, like, I mean, I appreciate the fact that he's not, like, one of those pop stars who's like, you know, I just want to go out there. Like, you know, like, Keri Hilson or someone who just kind of, just random, I've just pulled her name out of the ether, but, like, just,
Taylor Swift,
maybe? Right, like, they never say anything remotely interesting, you know what I mean? You see them in the interview, and they're like, you know, I just wanted to put out a good music that, you know, I feel like I've grown up a little bit, and I want to talk about the things, like, motherfucker, you know what I mean? Like, I just always
no,
just,
like, I don't like Taylor Swift either, but, like, you know.
But I mean, like, there's something to be said, I think, for Kanye's ability to kind of infuse a lot of otherwise, like, mundane celebrity ritual with a little bit of electricity. You know what I mean? Like,
but isn't it, like, faux interesting? Like, I mean, the things that he's gone through are, like, the things that are only relatable for celebrities. Because, like, you know, there's a lot of people that can relate to, like, their mom dying, right? Like,
right.
That's not, there's not, I mean, it's sad, right? But there's nothing, like, unique about that and, like, having to live with that pain. But, with, you know, I guess it's, like, the idea that, like, his pain is, like, somehow unique to somebody else's. I mean, other than, like, some of the things that he's brought on himself. And, I mean, the outcry after the Taylor Swift thing I thought was sort of ridiculous because, like, who takes that shit seriously anyway, right?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? But, like, I mean, beyond.
Also, let's not overlook that in that particular incident, I think Kanye was right. Like, I think that he shouldn't have won the award, but, you know.
But, I mean, that's what I'm saying. That's what's so annoying about him. It's like, yeah, so everyone agrees that she shouldn't have won the award. But it's like, you know, it's just, there's not every thought you have in your head doesn't need to be voiced all the time. You know what I mean? It's not like everyone was like, oh, but he was right. It's like, listen, you can't come to my fucking Thanksgiving dinner and put your balls in my mom's cranberry sauce because you don't like it. You know what I mean? Like, oh, well, this is how I felt. You know what I mean? I was just really, really. You know what I mean? Like, it's not okay just because you really felt it and that shit. It's kind of justified. You know what I mean?
Oh.
I just felt like that whole thing was such a cop out. Like, oh, we agree with him. So what? He still has to act like an adult. You know what I mean? Oh, like, so he was on Ellen, I don't know if you saw this, but he replaced the entire bottom row of his teeth. No one believes me when I tell him the story, because I'm like, it's everywhere, I'm not making this up. He replaced the entire bottom row of his teeth.
Exactly what you're about to say, and it did, it happened. I saw the picture.
And I'm not lying, and some people are like, oh, you're, I'm like, no, he had all of his bottom teeth removed and replaced with diamonds, right? Like, surgically removed and replaced with diamonds. And people are like, oh, you just, Kanye.
Are you for real?
No, that's what I'm saying. I'm dead ass. This is not like grills. It's not like he doesn't have fronts. He had his teeth surgically removed and replaced with diamonds. And I was like, if Kanye West, like, died, like, in an orgy in which he was impaled by a unicorn horn, like, you were just like, of course. Like, that was, you know what I mean? Like, of course that shit happened. Ellen was kind of having this conversation with him, like, you know, and she was kind of like, oh, so I hear you've had some work done on your teeth. And he's like, yeah, you know, I thought my regular teeth, you know, Kanye, I thought my regular teeth, Ellen, wasn't shiny enough. You know, and so he has diamonds in his teeth, which means that his top teeth now are going to be worn down because his bottom teeth are made out of the strongest substance in the universe.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's like, I mean, I don't know. I'm going old man here again. But, I mean, it's not like, you know, he's like, made music like Stevie Wonder, like there's like some sort of real political bent, or like there's something like really touches some sort of really deep emotional, you know, chord that like a lot of people can relate to, you know, like a lot of what he talks about is relatable to him and it's really good. I mean, I'm not going to deny him his musical, you know, ability, but like, I mean, just the hype that surrounds him is sort of, like, ridiculous. But, I mean, you know, I mean, I'm not going to begrudge him that because I kind of felt the same way about, like, Madonna. Like, when I was in middle school, I was like, what the hell? Like, why does everybody care about Vogue? Like, what is, like, old people dance like that, right? Like, you could go to any, like, you know, juke joint, you know, in downtown Houston and people are, like, dancing slow and, like, posing, right?
Right,
you know, so, yeah, so, I mean, that doesn't make him unique. I mean, he's just doing it all over again.
Right.
But, like, you know, I guess maybe some of the, like, hyperbole that goes along with it is sort of ridiculous. And maybe, you know, some people really have, like, you know, an emotional attachment to him. My mom was like, well, I just could, like, kind of relate to him when his mother died because it reminded me of you and me and his relationship. And I'm just like, what? Like, come on, man.
Like, all right, so we should go to shout-outs. Jamal, you want to go first?
I guess I'll shout out my camera, which I got 2 months ago, and it's been really fantastic. It's a Pentax KX released last year. It's a digital SLR, and it's just been really, really great. As far as my food photography is concerned, especially. So if you want to check out my photography, you can find me on Flickr, JBuoy, and if you want to check out my food blog, that is, it's called Chop from Buoy.
Nicole?
So I have 2 shout-outs, one of which I told Jamel that I would make because I have been doing an ungodly amount of baking because I have issues and decided that I was going to do the Food Network, like, 12 days of cookies. So I've basically made a batch of cookies pretty much every day for the last 2 weeks. And I found out today that Jamel does not bake with parchment paper, which is just insane to me because it makes everything so much easier. So I promise, I'm shouting out parchment paper because it's amazing.
Wow. Wow.
But the other thing that I wanted to shout out is, like, a little goofy, but it's that time of year. So Google Voice has this website that you can go to called sendacallfromsanta.com, and it'll send a personalized call from Santa to whoever you want. And, like, I did it to one of my coworkers, and it's pretty funny, but I also have a couple of little cousins, and I sent the call to them, and let me tell you, getting a personalized call from Santa Claus when you were, like, 8 years old is pretty much the coolest thing ever. So, like I said, it's kind of dorky, but if you have or know of any small children, it's actually pretty cool, and, like, if I were that age, it would be the sort of thing that would make me feel really special and awesome because, you know, Santa knows who I am and, like, talks to my family and knows what I want for Christmas and stuff like that. So that's my shout-out.
Well, that's what's up. Joel?
Well, as always, I have, like, 4 things to shout out.
It's been a while, so.
Yeah, no, right. I've been building up. No, actually, it's 2. One of them is going to be maybe unpopular, and the other one is something that probably most people on this podcast aren't going to care about. One is Cam Newton. I mean, this weekend, if you're at home, I haven't watched the Heisman Trophy presentation in years, mostly because, like, you know, once the regular season of college football is over, I just, like, start having to do all the things that I haven't been doing all fall. But this year, I'm going to sit at home and I'm going to watch it. Cam Newton is a quarterback for Auburn University, and, you know, Auburn's going to be playing in the national championship game in about three weeks. And he's the prohibitive favorite to win the Heisman. And in my opinion, he's certainly had the most dominant season that I've ever seen from a college football player. And so I think that there's a lot of things that are swirling around him. There's NCAA scandal as to whether or not his father solicited almost $200,000 for his signature to go to school. There's a lot of things swirling around him. So I think this is going to be really interesting and riveting TV to see what happens when he wins the award, because it's pretty much, you know, a done deal. Yeah, it's a lock. He's going to win. So I think that'll be interesting. Right after that, there'll be another great documentary on college football, but I'm not going to bore you all with that. And the other thing that I'm going to shout, my mother told me that I should mention this on the podcast today about Elizabeth Edwards, about paying my respects and, like, you know, just sending our thoughts and prayers out to their family. But the unpopular part of this is that, like, I really, like, I don't know where John Edwards is right now, but I really feel sorry for him. And I haven't heard a lot of people say that out loud, because it's probably not the right thing to say, because it's really easy to vilify him right now. I think a lot of people focused on, like, demonizing him following Elizabeth Edwards' death. But, like, I really, really, really have a lot of sympathy for that guy. It's not really a shout out, but it's just something that, you know, that I've been thinking about a lot over the last couple days, about, you know, a guy who had, you know, a lot to look forward to. He had a bright political future. You know, he was a really important person in public discourse, and now he's just sort of been, like, shelved off to the side here. And I think a lot of people, like, use his wife's death as another chance to take shots at him. And I just, I don't know. It's sort of weird to me, and it sort of disturbed me. So anyway,
I think you're right. I think it seems like a cheap way. Like, this is a really tragic event, and it seemed like a cheap way to kind of take shots at this guy. Monica?
I have two shout outs. So the first thing I'm going to shout out is Brokey McPoverty's post on Post Bougie about how people should stop listening to Steve Harvey. And he has he had one book about how, what was it, act like a lady, think like a man, or something like that. It's really condescending and horrible relationship advice book. And now he has another one based on the success of the first. And it's a really funny post, and it's especially funny because she has some suggested book subjects for Steve Harvey. And I've been giggling about them for 2 days. They're really hilarious. The other thing I'm going to shout out is Community, which everyone should know is a really funny comedy on Thursday nights on, I think, NBC.
It's NBC.
Yeah. I don't know because I watch everything online. And so I'm about to watch the Christmas special, but the Christmas special is going to be a stop motion animation Christmas special, like the old Frosty the Snowman.
And not Frosty, that was Rudolph. Frosty was animated, regular animation.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Stop motion Frosty.
There was a stop motion Frosty, though, yeah.
Was it really?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to shout out the Stuyvesants, which is this instrumental group based here in Brooklyn. Naima, who's one of the Post-Bougie contributors, put up one of their songs the other day as one of the random midday hotnesses. And it's really dope. I mean, if you like, it kind of sounds like Dilla instrumentals almost. Like, so it's really, really mellow. It's just really, and kind of like haunting. If you're not paying attention, you kind of, you know, get zoned out. It's like perfect for like a, you know, the late fall when, you know, the sun goes down early and, you know, you're walking down the street all bundled up. Thank you guys. I want to thank Monica and Jamel especially because they went to the American Prospect holiday party and soldiered this entire podcast kind of fucking drunk.
I'm not that drunk.
I'm not that drunk either. I'm just tired.
This is what drunk people always say, just for the record.
Yeah. I'm just tired. I just want to take a nap.
Absolutely.
I just wish I brought that pie home with me, that whole pie that I can eat right now.
So on behalf of the Post Bougie fan, Jamel, Nicole, Joel, and Monica, we will see you soon. Be easy, everybody.
Our theme music is 8 by Aeon. You can catch us at postbougie.com.